Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Each of my next guest's novels offer a sense of place and a sense of dislocation. The author Laura Lippman's writing always feels grounded in a precise spot, most often her hometown of Baltimore. And it feels dislocated because her characters, robust, boisterous, and oh so human, collide with defining choices and with tragedy. Lippman is perhaps best known for her Tess Monahan series, 12 so far and counting. Her newest has a new heroine and takes place in mid-1960s Baltimore. At its core is a refreshingly shrewd, mature, and honest take on what it was to be a woman, be she married or divorced, black or white, virtuous or flawed, in an era and place where categories seemed binary and where her only choices for honorific were miss or misses. This hour On Point, Laura Lippman and her new novel, The Lady in the Lake. Join us. Stephen King's a big fan, are you? Here's your chance to ask Laura Lippman about her characters, her plots, her hometown of Baltimore, the art of writing, and more. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. With me from New Orleans is Laura Lippman. She's a former journalist and one of the country's most successful crime writers. Her newest novel is called Lady in the Lake. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Laura, pleasure to have you on Point.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We have you by phone at the moment, I guess a little audio verite. We'll see if we can get you in the studio shortly, but delighted to have you. And I don't know, I guess I could claim it's a journalistic disclosure. It could also be something of a humble brag. You and I shared a terminal, call it 25 years ago, back at the Baltimore Sun. So listeners should be aware of that. I saw you in action. I was a cub and you knew what you were doing, which was a fairly strong contrast at the time. But let me just say in retrospect, thanks for sharing the terminal.
I remember that well. They were called coyotes, and we had them on little turntables, one for every two reporters.
The thing I remember was when you were on Deadline, I had to go deep into the Sports Night copy desk to find a terminal. And the other thing I remembered was the way in which there were no emails. You sent top-line messages by putting the person's last name and then writing something. So I wrote at one point, I think, to you something along the lines of, "Good Pastor is driving me crazy," which, of course, went to my then-editor, the late Ed Goodpaster. What
Everyone
can you do?
Everyone had to make that mistake at least once at the Baltimore Sun.
At least two or three times. Laura, we've been talking, in recent days about these terrible shootings and tragedies that have happened in Ohio and in Texas. You approach things with sensitivity and care and thought, just as you did as a reporter. You're such a tremendous novelist and writer. Why does crime, why does this form genre appeal to you so much?
The crime genre is an interesting one because it's a conservative genre with primarily liberal practitioners, not entirely, but most of the crime writers I know tilt left in their politics. But the crime novel used to presume that the status quo was worth restoring. It took the idea that there had been a horrible, usually homicide, but it could be any kind of crime that created chaos and disorder in a community, and that in finding out the who of it, the why of it, people could somehow be restored. I think modern crime fiction is moving away from that idea, but that there's still this obsession with what crime tells us about ourselves, not just when it happens to us, but how we respond to crimes that happen to other people.
Mm-hmm. And you also have talked a little bit about the way in which you think about writing the victims of these crimes. And in fact, actually, I think the first reading I have for you involves one of the key people who dies in the course of this book, a character named Cleo Sherwood. Do you want to read that passage for us?
Sure. Alive, I was Cleo Sherwood. Dead, I became the Lady in the Lake. A nasty, broken thing, dragged from the fountain after steeping there for months, through the cold winter, then that fitful, bratty spring, almost into summer proper. Face gone, much of my flesh gone. And no one cared until you came along, gave me that stupid nickname, began rattling doorknobs and pestering people, going places you weren't supposed to go. No one outside my family was supposed to care. I was a careless girl who went out on a date with the wrong person and was never seen again. You came in at the end of my story and turned it into your beginning. Why'd you have to go and do that, Madeline Schwartz? Why couldn't you stay in your beautiful house and your good enough marriage and let me be at the bottom of the fountain? I was safe there. Everybody was safer when I was there.
So I want to turn to a minute to your heroine, Madeline Schwartz, and ask why she had to go and do that. But talk a little bit about how you approach writing, in this case, actually in the first person, from the perspective of the person who was killed, how you go about kind of conceiving of and thinking of how to treat people who are the victims of killers in your crime novels.
Well, in particular with Cleo, this is an odd bit of trivia about the book. I believe it was Billy Wilder's birthday, and someone on social media was circulating some of Wilder's ideas about writing, which are all quite good.
The great Hollywood writer.
And, of course, he wrote Sunset Boulevard, one of my favorite films, one of the few films I think is better with voiceover. And, of course, it begins with William Holden narrating his own death. He's face down in a swimming pool, and he's going to tell you the story of how he got there. I have always been focused on victims, and it's always been my belief that the crime novel can do something that nonfiction can't, which is it can expand and create empathy for victims, because when people are reading a crime novel, they're not trying to reassure themselves, this will never happen to me. It's fiction, so they're assuming it's not going to happen to them, whereas when we hear about crimes in our hometowns or in places such as Dayton, El Paso, there's this very human desire to figure out why you're not at risk for it. And it tends to not shut down empathy, but erode it a little bit. You're trying not to identify with the victim. And crime fiction opens the door to let people relax and to think about the victim. When I came into crime writing, there were a lot of really good people starting out. I mean, I sort of started not long after Dennis Lehane, George Pelecanos, some really outstanding people who were writing very thoughtful, almost social novels. But there was another strain of crime writing that made me sad, which was books that attempted to find sensation simply through really high numbers of deaths and really sadistic deaths. And in particular, I would never name names, but there is a book that began with the body of a prostitute in a trash can and all the cops standing around cracking wise. And it's true, cops, in order to sort of deal with what they see, have pretty dark senses of humor. But it just made me sad to see these books where the dead almost seemed to be MacGuffins. They were just there to set the story in motion, and it was really about the protagonist and what he or she was going to learn and how they were going to become better people through death investigation. So I've always tried to make the victims in my book as human as possible, not to dwell on violence, not to try to be creative and imaginative in my methods of dispatch. But it was never more important with this book that the first and last word had to be given to this victim, Cleo, who, even though she's speaking across a void, is very canny and understands that, as she says later in the book, Madeline Schwartz isn't interested in her life. She's interested in her death, and they're not at all the same thing.
It's a remarkable book in this. I mean, it's an incredibly compelling read, but it's also a remarkable book in that it does convey a sense of place and of person. And we'll talk about Maddie Schwartz and her frailties as well as her frailties and failings as well as her strengths. But that it also has some extraordinary twists in terms of the mystery itself and the crime itself. Let's turn to Maddie Schwartz. She's a new creation. You've written a lot about Tess Monahan, who, you know, from the outset, this former reporter turned investigator. Now you have Mattie Schwartz, who's a woman in 1960 Baltimore, a homemaker, mother of a teenage boy, who decides to plot a new course for herself. What appealed to her about to you about her?
Well, Mattie Schwartz was my homage to one of my favorite characters in literature, Marjorie Morningstar. Marjorie Morningstar would have been a little more than 10 years older than Mattie Schwartz, and she grew up wanting to be an actress, promising herself that she would never be another one of those overdressed mamas from the suburbs. But that is how she ends up. And the last time we see her in this beautiful, vast book written by Herman Wouk, we see her through the eyes of a younger man who had yearned for her and tells himself he's so happy they didn't end up together because she's way too old for him. And I reread the book frequently, and I was shocked on my last reread to realize that Marjorie Morningstar, when she's much too old for Wally Ronkin, is 39.
Huh.
And that really stuck with me. And I began thinking about an alternative version, a version in which what happened the next day, what if Marjorie, in meeting someone who knew her when she was young, found herself stirred up again, thinking about what she wanted to be and how she had, in effect, broken the promises she made to her young self. And, I mean, there's no question in my mind that Marjorie Morningstar is a happily married woman who never thinks twice about that meeting with an old would-be flame. But in my version, set 10 years later with a woman who's just a slightly bit younger, in a time when women were beginning to sort of re-examine, well, what am I now? I've been a wife and a mother. My child is going off to college. My husband's already talking about retirement, which seems forever away. Is this it? You know, the Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is, would have been on the radio perhaps a few years after this. And Mattie Schwartz is someone who, if you had asked her the day before the book began, she would have told you she was a happy, contented person who had exactly what she wanted. And then the next day she's not, and she has to, she keeps telling herself she has to find a way to matter.
And we'll be picking that right up after this brief break. I'm talking with the novelist Laura Lippman about her new book, about Baltimore, about what life was like back then for people who didn't want to fit in the mold society had assigned them, be they black, white, gay, straight, rich, poor. You can join our conversation. What are your questions for the author and novelist Laura Lippman? What interests you most about her writing or how that era of the 1960s is depicted in fictional accounts? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. Laura Lippman is my former colleague at the Baltimore Sun, but more importantly, one of this country's most successful crime novelists. And she's my guest today. She's out with a really compelling new book, and she's brought that reporter's eye for telling detail and human connection to evoke life in that book from mid-1960s Baltimore. You can join our conversation. What do you look for in a crime novel? And do you find it in Laura Lippman's books? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Laura Lippman is in New Orleans today, where she splits time between her homes in New Orleans and Baltimore. She joins me from our NPR member station, WWNO, to talk about the new book, already a bestseller, The Lady in the Lake. I want to talk to you, Laura Lippman, a little bit more about Mattie Schwartz. She sort of taking a reverse path that you did as a former newspaper reporter, right? She wants to go into finding things out. She wants to, as you just said before the break, do something that matters in her life. Why is it that reporting becomes the thing that matters to her?
I think she sees it as one of the few doors open to her. She was, as a young woman, interested in writing. She worked at the school newspaper. She's continued to read seriously. She takes the world seriously. But she stumbles into it by helping find the body of a girl who's gone missing and been murdered. And that brings newspaper men to her door. And it makes her see, well, why can't I write the story? And she begins to try to find a way in, first by developing a story that is of interest to the newspaper, and then landing a job there, only to find out that she's going to basically be a clerk. And she's not encouraged at all to think that she could become a reporter. Although there are female reporters there, she's in her late 30s. She doesn't have the kind of background that they think she would require. So she's going to have to find yet another story to convince them that she can, in fact, be a reporter.
There are interesting things in the book that, you know, felt to me, maybe in some ways there's still elements of that true in the 1990s when we were in the newsroom there. But there are things in the book that reflected both the newsroom and I wonder if that spoke for Baltimore or the newsroom. There's a point at which you talk about how Maddie decides that she's going to talk to men. She's an attractive woman. She feels she's held on to her looks in the old age of her late 30s, right? And she decides that she's going to deal with men, that women are not that interested in helping mentor her, helping her propel from a very lowly job that she translates a scoop into helping her further propel her career to be more of a reporter on her own standing.
That was generally not my experience. You know, I probably first walked into a newsroom in 1980 when I was an intern at the Wilmington News Journal. And then the same year I went to the Atlanta Constitution. And in the Atlanta Constitution in particular, I found women who really were trying to mentor the young women. Mm-hmm. But man, I met a couple along the way that were just so indifferent to other women and who felt like they had worked so hard to get what they got and they weren't going to hold a handout. So I sort of saw it on both sides. And I was really grateful to the women who had come before me in newsrooms because they had to be super tough. They had to be better than everyone else. I didn't feel that as a woman entering journalism in the 1980s. I didn't feel like I had to be so much better than every single male colleague I had. And, you know, I've made the joke, although it's a truth, that by the time I got to newsrooms, you were allowed to cry as long as you went and did it in the bathroom. You couldn't sit at your desk and weep openly. That would be too weak. But you at least could have a little bit of weakness if you knew enough to hide away while you were doing it. And I think the generation of women before me weren't even allowed that luxury.
There's also something that struck me was that the woman who you read at the outset, the victim, the woman who was killed, who materializes to become a narrator, she's black. And one of the points that's made is that the cops care less about it. They have a special designation for black victims in a way in which they, although as you point out, cops can be callous and indifferent in talking about murder victims, perhaps to inure themselves to the fact it happens so frequently. They're especially indifferent, as depicted in the book and often in reality, to those who are black victims at that time. But that was reflected in the newsroom as well. That is the Afro-American, which was a real, you know, African-American paper in the city of Baltimore and a notable one, you know, had been covering your black character's death in a way that the stand-ins for The Sun, the various – and the News American and the various papers that are represented in fictional form here in your book are not really that interested. Hey, that's just a black victim. We don't really have to pay attention.
That was taken from real life. I mean, Lady in the Lake was inspired in part by a mysterious death that's never been classified as a homicide. It involved a woman who disappeared in 1969 and was found months later in the fountain at the park. No one knew how she got there. They couldn't even establish how she died. The Afro-American had covered her disappearance, but it was only when she was found dead that it became a story in the daily newspapers, and not much of one. And I happen to believe that if the location of her body had not been as odd and mysterious as it was, she would have received even less attention. You know, one of the books that I had read along the way and went back to reread in deciding to write this book was Russell Baker's memoir of working at The Sun in the 1940s and into the 50s. And he remembered one of his early days. It's called The Good Times. And he writes about, you know, being this very eager, ambitious young cop reporter. And as you know, the system back then, the cop reporter made the rounds but called information into a rewrite who shaped it into a story. And he was excitedly dictating the information he had from one of the first homicides he covered. And the rewrite stopped him and said, wait a minute, you know, that neighborhood, is this a black woman? Although he probably didn't say black. And mm-hmm. Baker said yes. He said, that's not a story. So that's only 10 to 15 years removed from the newsroom that Madeline Schwartz enters in 1966.
Mm-hmm. What appeals, and apparently through the magic of audio, we now have you in studio, so thanks to our friends at WWNO for making that happen. But what about that period particularly appealed to you to write about?
I started looking at 1966 because I was aware that there were some interesting parallels with the governor's race of 1966 and the presidential race of 1966. And that's what propelled me into the year. That part of the story became very unimportant, almost background. But 66 itself, I felt, was an interesting year nationally, but also very much so in Maryland and Baltimore. At the beginning of 1966, African Americans who worked for the Baltimore Police Department could be patrols or they could work in vice and undercover roles. That was it. They couldn't be detectives. They couldn't drive a car. They weren't even allowed to have radios. By the end of that year, Baltimore City would have hired a new commissioner who was going to fast-track, who would end up fast-tracking the promotions of many black officers, and black officers became detectives, and that was a big deal. So that was interesting to me. And the more I looked into 66, the more I began to see that it was this hinge year. When we think about the 60s, we tend to think about the late 60s, 68 and 69, 69 being very present right now because of the film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes we think about the early 60s and the promise of the Kennedy administration and how that changed with his assassination. We think about Vietnam. 66, if you had asked me before I started researching this book what I knew about 1966, I would have told you that was the year the Baltimore Orioles won the World Series in 4 straight against the Dodgers. That was about it.
I want to see if we can take a call now from Newton, Massachusetts. Sherry's been standing by. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, this is Sherry, and thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is a thrill to be talking with Laura Lippman and with you, David. Laura, I'm a big fan of your writing, and David asked a few minutes ago what people look for when they're looking for a mystery to read, what they're looking for in a writer. I have a particular affinity for female protagonists written by female authors. I think they bring a different sensibility to the work than men do when they write. There tends to be less violence and less gruesomeness and more about character and the relationships. And I certainly find that in your books.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that vote of confidence. I mean, I do know some men who achieve that, and I do know some women who write rather gruesome books. But I think the thing that I find common among the female crime writers I know is that we have this consciousness of having been, I don't mean to overstate it, but women grow up in the United States with almost a sense of having been prey at one point or another, a sense of not always being safe, of having to be careful. And I think that mindset is helpful when writing crime novels.
Want to take a call now from Baltimore, Maryland, your hometown, Laura. Susan is on the line. Thanks for calling in, Susan.
Hi, Laura, and thank you so much for talking with us today. I just want to say thank you. I echo everything that the previous caller said. I also want to say I think that your courage in addressing from a critical point of view kind of white participation in the racial dynamic that happens all over the United States. You said a phrase, I wish I could remember the novel, but there was something about a white woman going into a donut shop where one of the characters was working, and the phrase, white women in a hurry, man, that knocked me for a loop. So thank you for that. It's just so exciting to see somebody writing about these subjects in a really interesting way. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your call, Susan. Go ahead, Laura.
Thank you so much. It was so kind. I'm not sure it's courage per se. I do think it's really important that white people in general, white crime writers in particular, be very conscious of white privilege, of our taking it for granted that we're always at the center of stories. I wrote one book recently in which I decided not to delineate anybody's race. The main character's race was obvious from the fact that she showed up on page one with a sunburn and red hair. But other than that, the book was full of characters of races that weren't mentioned at all. And I thought I was doing something interesting and post-racial. And then a friend said, no, everyone's just going to assume that the people in the book are white. Absent, at least white readers will, and sort of absent. So I've really been thinking very hard about this. And Lady in the Lake is fairly meta in that Maddie in many ways represents the person I'm afraid I'll become if I'm not careful. Someone who's so intent on the one story that she holds dear that she will become incurious about others and fail at her ability to empathize. You know, Maddie goes through this book like a heat-seeking missile focused on one story, and she has no idea that the people she talks to and the people she interacts with, they all have stories. And if she would just slow down and pay attention, she might have found a way to write her way onto the newspaper without counting on the death of Cleo Sherwood to make her a star.
You know, there's moments where you're careful to say without being didactic about it, this is somebody who's not quite listening to everything around her. And maybe it was because she came from a wealthy family or a comfortable family, and that she had looks and she was white, that she could be sort of oblivious to all the array of people around her who had insights, whether it was her boyfriend, a black police officer, a waitress, somebody else who, you know, a sibling, a parent of some of the people she was interested in, who really could tell her some things.
Yeah, she's got some bad habits. I've taken to saying that it's great to want to be a human interest writer, but it helps to have some interest in humans along the way.
You know, one of the things that you talked about recently is you talked about the tentativeness that you feel at times in writing, not only about African-American characters, but in their voice, and that's a very delicate thing to pull off as a white author. I think we have an excerpt or a link to that essay on our website, among the other things that we provide to listeners if they go to our site. But what is your trepidation and how do you resolve that?
There have definitely been books, successful books, books that people adored, that fell into the trap of what is often called, quote, magical Negro, end quote, where the black characters seem to exist only to cheer on and affirm the goodness, wonderfulness of a main white character. Again, I don't like to name names or drag anybody. There's just no joy in that. But it is a problem, and it is a dilemma, and it's a little bit unseemly. At the same time, it would also be unseemly for me to suggest that I found a solution or that I know how to do it. What I've decided for myself is to risk failing at it and to try to think hard about it. And I'll tell a story on myself, which I think is funny and instructive. It's common for crime writers to auction off names in their books for good causes. And I did that at a recent fundraiser for my daughter's school. And the person who bid is a politician in Baltimore with a very distinctive Indian name. And I ran into him recently at a block party. And he asked about the use of his name and how it was coming along. It'll be in my next book. And I was so proud of myself. And I said, oh, Tharu, I have made you a neurologist. And he looked at me with such sadness and said, really, Laura? Really? You had to go straight into the cliche of the Indian man being a doctor? And I thought about it. And I said, wow, thank you for that. There are really not a lot of other parts I could give your name to, but how would you like to be a literary agent? He said, I would much rather be a literary agent. And so there I was, well-intentioned as heck, thinking I was doing a good job, and I failed. I mean, it wouldn't have been the worst thing in the world, but it did, you know, it did reveal a bit of bias in my thinking, and I'm okay with being called out on it. And I guess that's the conversation I'm urging. I'm trying to have it, and I'm urging my colleagues to have it, which is listen when you're called out. Think about these books in which people write about people of color as if they're food and they're cocoa colored and they're mocha colored and they're cafe au lait. And it's like, you're not writing that way about your white characters. That should suggest something to you that perhaps you should be avoiding.
Well, and if to think about names in your books, if I'm not mistaken, Madeline is your middle name. Maddie, your heroine here, and Tess Monahan, your earlier protagonist. If I recall correctly, Monahan, your mother's maiden name. Is that right?
No, Monahan was the name of the neighbors.
The neighbors,
very big
I'm
Baltimore
sorry.
Name.
Makes an appearance in this book as well, right?
It was our colleague Jacques Kelly's mother's maiden name. And if you remember back to the Baltimore Sun.
And there are few people more Baltimore or more of a particular kind of character in this book than Jacques Kelly, to be sure. We're talking crime novels, the worlds they describe. Famous critics in decades past dismissed detective and mystery fiction as just a popular genre. Lippman's work transcends category while staying true to its best traditions. She's also fostered a cohort of new women authors. What appeals to you about crime thrillers and about Lippman's writing and her mysteries? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik, and I'm talking this hour with the award-winning novelist Laura Lippman about fiction, about writing, about journalism, about her hometown of Baltimore. Her new book is called Lady in the Lake. You can join our conversation. Which of her books have you read? What questions do you have for Laura Lippman? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm going to take a call in a moment or two, but I wanted to give people a feel for your writing and a feel for the sense of the Baltimore of the 1960s that you're evoking. I guess in our third reading, there's a character named Donald Weinstein, who's the brother of a friend of the narrator's, and she doesn't quite fully understand where he's coming from. Why don't you read around this reading and tell us a bit about him?
I will, and I'll remind the Tess fans out there that this is actually Tess Monahan's uncle, who has been met before. Donald Weinstein. My life, my preferences, plenty of people know, but no one ever talks about it. I guess people, my boss, my sister, think they're doing me a favor, ignoring the obvious, making jokes about Baltimore bachelors. I have two friends, Ron and Bill. They share a little house in an out-of-the-way neighborhood up in the Northwest, and everybody seems to think they're just two swinging single guys on the prowl for women. Ron drives a flashy little sports car. They're both handsome guys. I was over there on Halloween last year, and the boy across the street came to the door trick-or-treating, dressed as a woman. We all had a good laugh at that, gave the kid extra candy. One day he'll look back, connect the dots, a house full of men at a Halloween party. Heck, maybe one day he'll be one of us. Who knows? I was in my teens before I figured it out, in my 20s before I dared to act on my desires. And I have to be careful, while the Ezekiel Taylors of the world just have to avoid embarrassing their wives.
Ezekiel Taylor, a wealthy black Baltimore businessman in your story who has a girlfriend or two on the side. I remember when I was covering politics for The Sun in Baltimore in the mid-90s, there was a state senator who I thought was quite brilliant and shrewd, who still lived with his mother, who I believe fit into this category of people who even then, 30 years after the setting of your plot, was, my sense is, thinking along the same lines.
Baltimore bachelor was a term I first heard at the tax assessor's office when I was contesting the valuation of my house several years ago. Mm-hmm. And someone used it to describe a politician. I won't name him. It doesn't seem right somehow, even though he was someone whose life was often speculated about. And I filed the term away, as I often do in Baltimore. And I thought it was at once so charming and so offensive, if that makes sense. There seems something kind of cruel about it. And, you know, I've had this character, Donald, wandering through other books. He, you know, works in state politics. In that scene, he's on his way to a place called Leon's, which was one of the earliest gay bars in Baltimore, maybe the first. And I really wanted to think about what his life was like for him, you know, and how he was trying to manage being himself in a world where it was, I think, literally illegal in some ways for him to be himself.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a quick call now from Clarkston, Michigan. Greg is calling in. Greg, what questions do you have for Laura Lippman?
Hi there. I just want to let you know I'm very inspired by your thoughtful answers. I'm a high school English teacher, and I came pretty late to crime fiction personally. I have to admit I've never read any of your work, but I'm literally sitting outside of Barnes & Noble. I'm going to buy this book as soon as I'm done listening.
NPR gets results.
A couple of my favorite writers that I discovered late were Dennis Lehane and William Kent Kruger. And to something you've touched a little bit upon, I just wonder how do you approach writing about such violent topics, especially in light of things that happened this weekend, the last couple of days with the mass shootings. And it sounds like you're very thoughtful in approaching all these subjects, but I'd love to hear your answer because I have a hard time handing over crime fiction to my high school students sometimes because of the content. I hate to say that, but I'd appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Greg. You talked a little bit about that, Laura, but, you know, is this the sort of thing that's appropriate for high schoolers? And how do you think about that role? Obviously, you've seen public leaders blame Hollywood at times for violence. Most recently, in the last couple of days, you've seen the president and the chief Republican, the House of Representatives, blame video games, violent video games for the kinds of mass shootings that we've seen in recent days and recent years.
I think that's quite silly. I don't think it works that way. Every now and then, and it's really rare, there'll be a case in which someone will be arrested and they might have a book in their possession and it's suggested that they copied the book. They basically used the book as a blueprint to commit a crime. But the idea that it starts there. It's not as if an innocent person is walking along and they read a crime novel and they say, wow, I never thought about crime before. And look, here's a way to do it. I do think writing about crime right now is especially fraught. And again, I think a lot about victims. You and I both worked with Rob Hiasen, mm-hmm. who was one of the five people murdered at the Capitol Gazette last year. Mm-hmm. And I have been made more vividly aware of what crime does to the people who survive it, mm-hmm. Rob's family and friends. And at the same time, I mean, it's part of the world. We write about crime. We write about war. There's also escapist novels for when we don't want to deal with those things. It's interesting to me that some people consider crime novels escapism because they find it so distant from their own experiences. I wouldn't hesitate to give high school students crime novels by the crime writers I admire. The caller mentioned Kent Kruger, who's a friend, Dennis Lehane, a very good friend. It's a really small world, crime writing. And I can't see how a high school student wouldn't benefit from reading a book like Mystic River, which looks at the way something that happened when three boys were young changed them all, and that bill comes due many years later. I think it would be, if I were a high school student and that was assigned, I'd be very happy.
You know, you mentioned Rob Hiasen. He was a friend of mine. You were even, of course, closer to him than I was. And you dedicate this book to Rob, and you cite his name and those of the others killed at the Annapolis Capitol, Rob Hiasen, Gerald Fishman, John McNamara, Rebecca Smith, and Wendy Winters, as well as their loved ones. Why did you decide to do that?
There was an awful bit of timing with this book. I had been asked if I could sort of push and get it ready by July 1st last summer. And I got it done by June 27th and decided to drive to the Delaware Beach where my mother lives with my daughter, who would have been 8 years old at the time. And as we were finishing up lunch on the other side of the Chesapeake Bay, so we had, you know, driven through Annapolis, past Annapolis, I called my mother to tell her that We were about 90 minutes away, and she said, oh, did you get slowed down by traffic in Annapolis? And I said, no, why would there be traffic at this time of day? And she said, there was a shooting, and I'm obsessed to this day with that split second in which I ask so numbly, even maybe nonchalantly, oh, where was it this time?
Mm-hmm.
I hate that I said that. I wish it weren't so, but I'll never forget it because in that moment, in the next moment, when my mother said the newspaper, and I realized almost immediately that there was a likely chance that Rob would have been in the office at the time of the shooting. In the next moment, I realized that I had allowed myself to become somewhat numb, which in a way is what people who don't want to change our laws are counting on. They're just counting on us to be numb to these events, to be accepting of this new reality. And I realized in that moment that that's the one thing I can't do, that I have to be so angry and I have to continue to agitate for what I think are the correct changes. And I don't ever want to become numb again. I happen to believe, and I'm not being hyperbolic, at the rate we're going, everybody's going to have a first-degree connection to a mass shooting. We're now seeing that there are people, victims, who have been connected to multiple shootings. There was someone who escaped the shooting in Vegas only to be killed in, I believe, in Thousand Oaks. There were people at the Gilroy Garlic Festival who had been in Vegas. How can we think this is a way to live? How can we allow ourselves to become numb to this? And it's hard. It's really hard to not settle back into this numb, well, this is the new normal. But I'm resolved not to let it happen to me.
I think there were parents of the shootings of student in Parkland, Florida, who were in El Paso when this shooting happened there over this past weekend. Maria Hyacin, the remarkable widow of Rob, has devoted herself to the cause of gun control since the Annapolis Capitol shooting in a quite passionate way as well. You know, you talk about the numbness, and sometimes that's something people associate with reporters, sort of losing a connection with people they're writing about. In your book, Lady in the Lake, you reflect that as well at times in newsrooms. What about newsrooms do you love? Because you return to people who somehow are either journalists or journalist adjacent, right, in your writings. What is it that you hold on to as something that you care about from in the way in which newsrooms and particularly newspaper journalists operate?
I know it sounds corny, but I love the people. There was a collegiality about newsrooms. I always felt like I was part of the last generation that really got to have fun at work. Because that was the covenant, right? You got out of school, you took a job at a newspaper, and it was like, I can make a lot more money going into corporate communications, but I'm never going to have this much fun. Our former colleagues at The Sun, I don't know if they're having fun, although I think they had a great deal of fun last week, and they really rose to the occasion after Trump attacked Baltimore. But they've been working for 6 years without a raise. They're down to such incredible small numbers, and they still do amazing work.
It's remarkable.
So I admire them so much, and I admire their dedication and their ability to. They really are doing less with more. You know, Maddie's getting in.
They're doing more with less, I assume.
I'm sorry. They really are doing more with less. Thank you for catching my mixed up words there.
Sure.
Because it's amazing. I mean, the investigation into the mayor of Baltimore, which led to her having to step down, that starts at the Baltimore Sun.
And so much stuff on Freddie Gray and many other things as well. You mentioned the president, don't want to dwell on it, but, you know, he attacked Baltimore, disparaged it in tweets that I think you can certainly ascribe a racist inclination to by going after Congressman Elijah Cummings, who's represented that city in a variety of ways for decades. You know, at the same time, in your reporting, you covered poverty. Mr. Lippman, David Simon, the noted HBO screenwriter, director, creator, all the above, you know, has explored the dysfunction and the poverty in parts of Baltimore, as well as the crime there. How do you take such criticism for a city that you love, a region that you love, that is at once very proud and yet does have real problems in parts of it that are systemic and hard to uproot?
Look, I didn't need Trump to point out that Baltimore has problems. Part of living in Baltimore is every day trying to understand one's own relationship with it and how to make it better. And one of the things that's happened on a very small scale is I live in a truly city neighborhood very near downtown. I moved in there 17 years ago when I didn't have a child and wasn't sure that I ever would. And at the time, there was only one kid in the entire neighborhood. It was like the movie Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, as if the child catcher had come through and scooped them all up. And over the next decade, I watched my neighbors who were young people in their 20s and 30s who liked city life. They had kids, but instead of moving to the suburbs, they tried to find larger Baltimore row homes, and they went to work making our local public schools better schools. By the time my daughter was ready to enter first grade, it had become the rule, not the exception, to enroll your kid in the neighborhood school, to the point where the parents who are choosing private school for their children, and some do, offer reasons and excuses like, well, you know, I feel really bad. I'm not sending so-and-so to this school. But in our case, which, of course, there's no judgment at all, and my neighbors did this. But we can, again, going back to that idea of privilege, this is an upper middle class neighborhood. The rest of the city schools need help. They don't all have the family units that can commit the time and energy and sometimes financial resources to the schools. And I know that about the schools. I mean, I find the governor of Maryland to be incredibly hostile to Baltimore, and he has undercut it in so many ways. And I have not been particularly impressed by his attempt to speak to these issues in recent weeks.
Very briefly, we've got about 45 seconds left, but you've struck a deal which will allow you in future to write not only these kinds of books, but books of essays, more personalized writing. Tell us about that. What was the impulse for that?
Writing essays was something I started to do because it's almost seen as being part of the marketing plan of your book. Just get your name out there. Mm-hmm. But one night I had this wild impulse to write the story of what it's like to be a 60-year-old woman with a 9-year-old. I sold that to the Fine Line section of Longreads, and it became immensely popular. It's had over 100,000 views since it was published in May, and a follow-up I wrote has had 70,000 views. So, wow, look at me, Ma. I'm a personal essayist now.
A long read and a brisk read all at the same time. Laura Lippman is a crime novelist, a journalist, an essayist, and I should add a really thoughtful one at that. She's also an old friend. Her latest book is called The Lady in the Lake. You can read an excerpt from the book and one of her essays at her website, onpointradio.org. Laura, great to hear your voice again and to have you on the show.
So great to talk to you, David.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.